Hello and welcome to Hashtag Health. My name is Devin, and on today's episode, we'll be talking about the challenges facing emergency departments and hospitals across Canada. The emergency department is a vital component of an effective hospital. From larger city centers to small rural communities, physicians working in emergency medicine are tasked with solving some of the toughest medical problems. If you've followed healthcare news as of late, I'm sure you've heard about various emergency departments closing their doors for periods of time during troubles with staffing doctors and nurses. While COVID-19 appears to have pushed many healthcare workers to the brink, the staffing problem in our hospitals has been brewing for some time. In a rapidly changing healthcare landscape, issues with compensation, working conditions, lack of appropriate training, and more have all contributed to a work environment that is pushing healthcare workers away from the profession. In episode one of this two-part feature, we bring on Dr. Miriam Mann, an ER physician and former department chief, to talk about this issue. Enjoy.
I'm the first physician in my family and ended up in med school kind of as a surprise. It was sort of a lucky set of circumstances that landed me in med school at what was then called the University of Western Ontario. I'm a class of Meds 88. I decided that emergency medicine was my calling when I fell off a horse between first and second year and ended up in the emergency department. A fine emergency physician offered me an opportunity to come in and do electives starting through my second year. And that was how I fell in love with it and knew that's what I wanted to be. And I never really wavered from that. I decided that for me, my best choice was the Royal College program in emergency medicine, and was fortunate to be accepted at a master's program, and was there until 1993 and graduated from there. Then after working in Hamilton for a year, I decided to go north and worked in Sudbury for 5 years, which is where I always say that's kind of where I got my wings as an emerge physician. You know, your first sort of place where you're not the junior consultant having trained in that facility. And Sudbury certainly has a bigger knife and gun club than Hamilton did at that time. And lots of trauma from, you know, highways, you know, penetrating, hunting, you name it. I mean, it was such a thrilling and exciting department to work in with a really great group of colleagues. So I remember those days very fondly. We knew, though, that that wasn't going to be our home forever. Our second child was born in Sudbury and didn't meet either of his grandfathers until he was 6 weeks old because it was the winter. And we knew that we needed to get home to Southern Ontario because that's where both me and my ex-husband were from. So an opportunity came up in Stratford. Stratford was sort of midway between my parents' home and my ex-husband's family home. And a job came up as the chief of Emerge. And I applied for it, and my chief up north mentored me to help me through the application. I showed up and all of a sudden was chief of Emerge. And I remember waking up in the morning with imposter syndrome thinking one of these days they're going to figure out I don't know what I'm doing. And then I figured out what I was doing. I attended conferences on administration and had some personal coaching and kind of developed my career and my admin skills as the program developed. And I was chief for about 20 years and program director for the four hospital site for, I don't know, I'd have to say 5 to 7 years, but I'd have to check my CV to know that for sure. And I'm super proud that I went from a department that was staffed predominantly by family doctors, many of whom I will say were absolutely excellent in emergency medicine, to a really highly sophisticated department of full-time emergency physicians, career emergency physicians, and crackerjack nurses. And it's a department we're all really proud of, but probably most proud of was that as people came on and were recruited, they brought strength to the department. And when I handed off the role of chief to my colleague, Dr. Phil Shildroff, people ask if it was hard. It's like, no, it was easy because the person who's taken over is a fantastic chief. So now I'm a worker bee. I work part-time and I ski a lot and I travel my place in BC and I show up and I do my job and I support my chief because that's what I would have appreciated when I was chief. Our department, we work 8-hour shifts. They're 8 to 4, 4 to midnight, midnight to 8, and then there's a 1 to 9 shift. On our busiest days, we're now adding 12 hours of double coverage. So we have 2 6-hour shifts. I will say that for every 8 hours, you're typically there for 9 or sometimes 10. There, you can certainly hand over, but when the department is really busy and we're getting busier all the time, you don't necessarily want to hand over if you can stay an hour and wrap up your patients. And especially for someone like me, who I don't have little kids waiting for me to come home anymore, I'm more than happy to stay and wrap up my patients. I also find as I get older, I don't want to rush and see patients as quickly anymore. And at my age, I can't sort of push the volume the way I used to. So knowing that in my department that I'm not the fastest doc there, I don't want to hand over a lot either. So I just tend to stay and wrap up my patients because I've got a few more years of this to go. And I just enjoy that. And what do I care if I stay an hour late? The patients love it. I'm having a good time. I'm chatting with people. And so that's kind of works for me. For emergency physicians working in big cities, they're certainly working similar 8-hour shifts and may have better handover, but most of us work in excess of 8 hours for every 8-hour shift. And it's sort of said that you generate 2 hours of paperwork for every 8 hours you work. So that, and you have to at some point in time do those charts while you're in the department or afterwards or training or whatever. So in terms of hours a week, I only do a couple of shifts a week. I'm also doing some OR assisting though. So that is an added responsibility that I quite enjoy. When I was chief though, I was working again, the role of chief probably in many ways saved my career because I was able to work the admin work whenever worked for me. So I could go over, I could walk over to my office in the evening with my dogs and go in the back way and just close the door and get whatever administrative work I needed to get done. And because I was working a lot of admin stuff, I didn't work as many nights. At 61, I don't work nights anymore. I mean, if one of my colleagues got sick and I needed to, I of course would do that. But most departments have some sort of a mechanism where physicians over 60 or some other formula that people use stop doing nights, although it's individual specific. Some docs can work nights their whole career. For me, I was fine doing nights till about 58 and then a switch flipped and I was so physically nauseated by 6 o'clock in the morning that I was worse than useless. Stratford is always busy now. When I came there in 1999, the average number of patients per shift was somewhere in the neighborhood of 68 to 72. It was kind of the average, and you might have an 80 patient day that was busy. Over the 20 years, for many changes in healthcare and many reasons, the number of patients increased significantly. And we were, before the pandemic, we were probably seeing 80 to 85 on average a day. But probably more importantly was the acuity of those patients was significantly increasing over time. During the pandemic, the patient numbers dropped off dramatically in the first waves of the pandemic. And there's a lot of theories as to why. Most people think it was two main reasons. Number one, the patients didn't want to trouble us. They thought everybody in the hospitals are really busy with the pandemic. They don't need us there, so we'll stay home. Or number two, they were afraid of getting COVID and didn't want to come. The ironic thing was, in places like Stratford, where people flattened the curve and people stayed home, we didn't really have an early COVID wave. So in the early days of the pandemic, we were seeing 30 to 40 patients a day. I think our lowest was 24 in a 24-hour period. We had nothing to do. So like the department that I'm proud of, we took the time to do mock code blues, mock protected intubations. We got EMS in and we ran protected COVID code blues with EMS and how we were going to do that and how we were going to restructure the department based on all the upcoming COVID guidelines. And as a group, we all worked really hard to continue to develop and revise our COVID protocols. So that served us well when second, third waves in, we did start actually seeing significant numbers of COVID patients. Over the 2 years, the patients are all back and then some, and there's a variety of reasons for that. A lot of the patients' primary care was put on hold for a long time because of COVID. And so those patients are often, at least in the first, after about a year of the pandemic, they were showing up with their primary medical conditions, unmanaged and out of control, part because they hadn't been seeing their family doctors or they stayed home and just didn't access care at all. Family doctors have struggled with the role of virtual care and how they continue to provide that. So most family doctors are seeing people in their offices again. A lot are doing hybrid models now. And there's always going to be those patients who are offered a virtual appointment and don't choose to do that. So they come to the emergency department. That we have seen as well. But I just feel like people are just getting older and sicker and they're showing up in droves. We're now at a point where we have at least 100 patient day every single week. And we actually had our winner of 124 patients in a 24-hour period last month. It's crazy. So Sunday I was supposed to work 1 to 9, and my colleague texted me at 11:30, and she said there's already 17 people waiting to be seen. And some of them are, you know, if you get lucky, there's not a ton of acuity there. But I mean, if we look at our stats in Stratford, for any number of reasons, we're a referral center for several small hospitals. We have an active chemo program. We are a regional trauma center. So trauma would come, for example, if they're on the border between St. Mary's in here or Seaforth in here, they'll come to Stratford because we have the CT scanner. And there's a number of referral patterns that happen in that regard. Specialists get referral patients coming in, and then those patients see Stratford Emerge as their site. So if you are from Clinton and you've had surgery from one of the general surgeons, you have a complication, typically you come to our Emerge. You might go to Clinton Emerge, but they often show up in ours. So the acuity, we're pushing 25 to 30% triage level ones and twos on any given day. We certainly have some family medicine issues. There's a number of patients that don't have family doctors, but the vast majority of our patients in Stratford do have family doctors who do have pretty good access to their family doctors. And with family health teams, there's a lot they can access. So what that means is we just don't see you do see a little bit of primary care, people who choose to come to the Emerge rather than access their family physician, or maybe couldn't access a family physician for a variety of reasons. But a lot of it is just really high acuity stuff, because the low acuity stuff goes to where it's supposed to the family practitioner's office. It's always funny when Stratford is called rural, with our CT scanner 24/7 and our emergency physicians who all reduce fractures and do peritonsillar abscesses and all do complex suturing. And if I need to, I can beg, borrow an MRI from somebody if I really have to for an epidural abscess on most days of the week. You know, we had a really critically ill patient the other night, and both the anesthetist, we didn't have any ENT on call, but it was an airway obstruction case. Both the anesthetist and the general surgeon came in and handled it beautifully in a rural community. So it's not exactly, it's smaller, but well, of course, as a physician, I would like to say that it is always about the physician, right? I mean, that's sort of, yeah, it's always about me, but it's actually not about me. And the older I get and the more I see the problem with nursing shortages, the more I realize that the backbone of the healthcare system is our nurses. They are so skilled and can do so many things. And truthfully, when you've got a waiting room full of people, I have to count on the triage nurse and the primary nurses in the department to tell me who's the sickest. You know, I remember standing there one day going, okay, you know, four nurses have now come to me and said, I need you to see my patient next. What do I do? Where do you want me to go? And that's where your charge nurse or triage nurse comes in and says, do this one first, then this one. They're the eyes and ears, right? Like when I cannot be in every single place. And when you have a waiting room full of CTAS ones, twos, or God forbid the CTAS threes that are in many ways the highest risk, because they're the undifferentiated abdo pains and dizziness and all of those people that could be nothing or could be something really bad, because they're often elderly. So the nursing staff, I think, are underappreciated, underrepresented, and we'll talk a lot about the current nursing crisis, which is driving most of what is happening in healthcare right now. But I'd be remiss if I didn't say that I couldn't do my job without good respiratory therapists, good MLTs, lab technicians, good X-ray and MRT, medical radiation technologists, and all of those people who, crisis workers, we have crisis available in our department. I almost never primarily assess a mental health patient until they've been assessed by a crisis worker. And it took me a long time it took me some time to recognize that, why would I do something that somebody else can do as well as or better than me? So if you have a master's in social work and you're a crisis worker, why wouldn't I let that person do a proper mental health assessment and then weigh in and have a discussion with me and we make global decisions together? And that's so a highly functioning department is one where everyone is working to their maximum scope of practice. The nurses are doing the maximum that they are allowed to do. The crisis workers are doing the maximum to the best of their skills. And then you have your RTs doing what they're best at, your X-ray technicians doing what they're best at, your housekeeping staff. We sort of forget about them, but I've over the years, the changes in housekeeping, we have the same housekeepers in the department, and they're absolutely critical when you're trying to turn over rooms quickly, and they understand and they'll come out and say what was in this room, because a COVID clean is different than a varicella clean, which is different than a gastro clean. And if you don't do those things well, it's going to create more problems down the road. So it's that kind of team approach and recognizing that. Before COVID, we had volunteers, which were just fantastic in terms of meeting people's needs, going around, asking if they were okay, giving them a warm blanket. Because when wait times are long, just that little bit of extra kindness goes a long way. And I think as a chief, I think if there was a real strength, it was that ability to build bridges and make connections with other departments and work to build a team approach to things. I think our current chief, Phil, does that really well. I think he also, he was sort of, I think I was probably better at the soft and fuzzy stuff. And he really met, really got a handle on the finances. And I, by that, I mean, I was chief when they started negotiating the early, or then called the alternate payment plans, or the original contracts for emerge physicians, this goes back to the early 90s. And then, so the late 90s, early 2000s, when it was recognized that that the way we were paying emergency physicians just wasn't working, and we were going to have a major human resources crisis. And then over time, these contracts have changed as emergency care has changed. And Phil was able to demonstrate that while from a volume standpoint, under 30,000 visits a year, we didn't meet the criteria to move to the second tier model, what's called the workload model of the alternate payment plans, or what are the alternate funding arrangements now, based on acuity, we certainly were. And it changed our structure so that instead of having 24 hours of funding in a 24 hour day, you get, and that's kind of what all small hospitals are funded, is 24 hours of physician coverage in a 24 hour day. And if you work in a town like Clinton, where the physician might come and go from the hospital, can take breaks, can work for a 24-hour period or 2/12s or however you want to structure it, it's not a bad model for the smaller sites, although there are some issues. The bigger hospitals were all on this workload model, which you submit your hours and your acuity and a bunch of other factors that determine, like the number of CT scans you order is important because it tells you that the patients are a lot sicker than the patients who don't need CT scans, for example. So then your hours of funding are based on that. So you might get 34 hours of coverage in a 24-hour period. And then each chief has to decide, do I pay a second shift of 10 hours a day, or do I pay a second shift of 8 hours and bank 2 hours every day to cover for overtime, ambulance transfers? And every department handles that a bit differently. So I think with just changes in medical practice, in the way we provide care, but also, the traditional physician, if you look back to the historical traditional physician, was a male who probably worked 80 or 90 hours a week and was a jack of all trades. He did family medicine, he did emerge, he did obstetrics, he did inpatients. And even my family physician, who's in her early 60s as well, did emerge and obstetrics and inpatient care, and was always in the hospital on the weekends. That is a dying breed for many reasons. First of all, if you look at the dynamics of those families, those children never saw their father. It's recognized now that that's not a healthy way to live your life. Even if you could do it, that kind of older school physician is no one really thinks that that's a good way to practice. Number two, family doctors used to have a practice of like 2,500 patients, but a lot more just coming in for blood pressure checks and that. That's all gone too. So the patients who are coming in are sicker. They have more medical needs. There's more preventative care that a family physician needs to provide for each patient in their practice. So that's another reason that kind of jack of all trades model is gone. And so you look at family doctors working in small towns, and St. Mary's is a really great role model for this because they still have the model where they have family doctors who also do emergency medicine. And they have pretty much said as a group that if you want to come and do family medicine, then you're going to do emergency medicine. They don't do obstetrics. They have one or two docs who are not doing much eMERGE in lieu of something else that they do. And they have two docs there, I think two now, who both have an EM year, which is really helpful in terms of leadership. And then the family physicians they've recruited are docs who spent time with them and are interested in emergency medicine as well. So they keep up on those skills and they do a really, really great job. But there are probably a group of 10, maybe 12 with a history of excellence in both family practice and emergency medicine. But then if you say, let's step out into Clinton, which is a little bit further away, which had two or three historic family doctors who had huge practices and worked really hard. One left because his family needed to move for, I can't remember what the reason was. This would be over the last 20 years, my whole 20 years. One tragically died of an early coronary syndrome. Jan Rosinski was a fantastic family physician and was a tragic death. And they were left with two physicians who were kind of more senior. And you look at, well, can they do it all on their own? And the emerges were getting busier. So now you're like trying to do family practice. Your family practice is bigger. The demands of family practice are bigger than they used to be because the expectations under the funding models are that you do all this preventative care and you're covering the emerge department. And what's expected of you as an emerge doc is increasing. You can't just refer everyone on. You have to. So you ended up with these situations where they just couldn't cover emerges. And 15 years ago, the problem was no doctors to cover those sites. So the government reacted by bringing in the Health Force Ontario, where emerge physicians who were working full time at other sites, if they wanted to pick up at other smaller sites, they pay them a buttload of money to do that. And then that created the problem that the doctors plunking in from London or elsewhere were making more than the local doctors for working the same shift. So it's the, you know, the unintended consequences that created these problems. So that's kind of where the pre-COVID small town stuff came from. I know that's kind of a long-winded answer, but it really was very complicated. And that is everything I've said is with respect to all those people who were working in those environments.
If you're interested in hearing more of Dr. Mann's perspectives, stay tuned for part two of our ER Closure podcast series. My name is Devin, and thank you so much for listening to Hashtag Health.